I stopped questions the previous lecture when it was ending. You have more? You have something to ask? Yes.
Is there anything in the first order formalism that prevents E from being zero?
No.
So that's something different than GR. That's something different than GR. In GR, you need non-zero values.
Of course, all the solutions of GR are also solutions of this theory. And all the phenomenology that we know is well described by those solutions. So as far as our understanding of gravity is concerned, they're equally good. We don't know which one is better. There have been at some time some work trying to exploit this. And one is tempted to say that given initial condition in GR, you can reproduce in this theory and then they're the same. But you can give initial condition in GR that evolve into a similarity. So maybe in that theory something better happens. This was one of the hopes. The field configurations where either E or the determinant of E, some component of E, go to zero, might play a role in the quantum theory and might even play a role, an important role in the quantum theory. As far as we know, we don't know. Other questions? So, last lecture, lecture 5, was sort of the middle left in the middle of the story. I remind you that what happened last lecture was two things. I just gave you some various formulations of generativity in four dimensions. Then I switched to three dimensions, and I began what I'm doing today, which is a quantization of three-dimensional Euclidean, because it's easier, GR. I use generativity, since you just asked this question, I use generativity for all these series. They have the same classical equation of motion when you consider the... I don't use different names when I use tetrads or the whole section, even if, strictly speaking, they're defined by different actions, so there are subtle differences that may play a role in the quantum theory. I always call it GR. So in 3D, just to remind you where we were, the action, so 3D, Euclidean GR, the action is written in terms of the triad field E and SO3 spin connection omega, and it's given by S, which is a function of E, and omega, some constant in front, which let me just put it back. It's a pi g, because we might use it later. E which f of omega. So this is the action of GR. Let me add one thing. I didn't write the equation of motions for this action. If you vary omega, you get the torsionless condition of E, so as in four dimensions, the condition that omega is a spin connection of E. If you vary E, you get the Einstein equations, which in vacuum is just Ricci equals zero, but Ricci equals zero in three dimensions, it implies Riemann equals zero. Okay? So the Einstein equations in vacuum of this theory here are that the Riemann curvature is zero, so it's flat. And in fact, here you can even see it immediately without any much complications, because if you vary E, obviously you get F equals zero. And we saw that the Riemann tensor is just linear it's just proportional to the curvature of F, so it's zero. So in three dimensions, the equation of motion actually implies that the theory is flat, which means that this theory we're doing here is much, much simpler than Jerk's, enormously simpler than Jerk. In fact, it has no local degrees of freedom. It still has global degrees of freedom, because if you have a compact space-time with some dimension, it's going to grow, it's going to shrink, it's going to evolve globally according to equation of motion you can derive from here. But it's enormously simpler. So don't, let's not be fooled by the simplicity of this theory and take it to learn something. But then, of course, the other, the four-dimensional one will be more complicated. But nevertheless, a lot can be done here, which is exactly the same in 3D, in 4D, and that's what I'm doing. Okay, and then the quantization steps to go toward a quantum theory, it's going to be by a discretization of this theory, and then write the Hilbert space. The Hilbert space and the operators, and then write the transition amplitude for the discretized theory, as we've seen. So I have begun by describing you how to discretize this theory, and I've given you this picture. So we have a space-time broken tetrahedra, and we have tetrahedra. Faces and bones, and so on. This is a triangulation, and then we have the dual triangulation, where the dual of a tetrahedron is a vertex, B, call it, sorry, not faces, triangles. The dual of a triangle is an edge, E, and the dual of the bone is a face, F. So side here, there is a vertex, there are edges, and then the faces, which are dual to this bone here. And the idea is to invent some discrete fields living on this discrete object here, such that we can think that in a continuous limit give this, this goal, this give that, and write an action such that in the if the triangulation is sufficiently fine, it converges to the action there. Okay? And I just began to do that. And the idea was to introduce one element of R3 for each bone, which means for each face, and one element of SO3 or SU2, we'll discuss it in a moment, for each edge. So let me call it U for each edge, and let me say SU2. And I'll say in a moment why I use SU2 rather than SO3. Okay, so that's the quantities that I want to introduce. So I'll have these discrete quantities. So what do I have? I have a set of vertices, edge, and faces. These are equally called the two complex. So you just think vertices, edges, and faces. Okay. Where each vertex has four. So this is a face, that's another face, that's another face, and each vertex has four faces. So four edges, 1, 2, 3, 4. Put this picture in mind, another face here. So this is the discrete structure that we have in mind. What matters here is only the combinatorial thing. And on each of these E, we put a group element. On each face, we put a element of R3, a vector. That's what we have. And then we write an action, I'll write in a moment, and this will be a discrete theory. So why SU2? Well, the connection, the symmetry here is a rotation symmetry, right? So, and the connection is in the algebra of the rotation group. The algebra of the rotation group is, in fact, the same as the algebra of SU2. So as far as the connection is concerned, it doesn't know whether it's a SU2 connection or an SO3 connection. Right? Locally, it's just a field, which is a, you want an index, a transform under rotations in some manners. It doesn't know. We know that we want to later on couple this theory to fermions. So we know that in the representations, we expect to have spin half representations. So nothing prevents us to use SU2 instead of SO3 and put us in the conditions for having fermions later on. How to think about that? Well, in if you have an edge, and you have a SU2 group element attached to it, in the limit in which you think that you have a very fine triangulation, U is going to be close to the identity, right? So you can think there is a small edge with a U close to the identity. That U close to the identity means that is the identity plus an element of the algebra, first approximation, in the direction normal. Some algebra element, okay? In the direction normal to the to the link itself, to the edge itself, and if this is the algebra, you can write it as in some basis. For instance, if it is this is SU2 algebra, I a basis like the sigma matrices, sigma I. So in any point, in any vertex to every edge, you have something like that. So if you have many, if you have a fine triangulation, you have a field, omega I of x, and that is what you're going to identify with this field here. Okay? So if I give you an object like that, in a, I'm giving you a discretization of an omega. And the same for the E's, they live on faces, but you can think that they are sitting on bones, it's easier. So given every bone here, you have, I have an E in R3, which once again I can when this is small, identify. So this is a bone. I can identify with what precisely? So write E as E A dx A. This is dx A I here. So this is the tetra field. And of course, as I wrote before, under this identification, you can always go to coordinates where this is flat, and you see immediately that the length of this link, of this bone, is the norm of this R3 element associated to it. So this equation, which I wrote the other time, the length square of the bone is equal to the norm of the EI, the vector, if you want, of the corresponding face. Which we'll use in a moment. Okay, so these are the discrete fields. Okay. As usual, when you do a discretization, the discretization itself is well defined. The relation with the continuous series is tricky. It's just messy. And what is missing is to write an action, and there's an obvious action here, which is just a trace of EU. For U, what is U? So that's, we have to understand what is the so U sits on edges, the SU2 group elements. So when you have a face, you can multiply the group elements around the face, and you get a group element associated with the face itself, which is sort of the holonomy of connection going all around it. But the holonomy of connection going around it is 1 plus the curvature. It says how much is the curvature when you go around this. So makes us to define UF just as a product UE1 UEN, where E1, EN are the edges around the face. In the triangulation, what we're doing, we're going these edges around, we're moving around this bone here, right? So we have a bone and we're going around. And if you think that in each of these tetrahedra, the metric is flat, for simplicity, imagine you're a flat metric, a flat metric, a flat metric, a flat metric, a flat metric. When you parallel transport around with a connection, if you turn out curved, it means that somewhere there's curvature, so there's curvature of this bone. So if this UF is different from 1, it means that in the corresponding bone there is curvature. Right? It's the way of measuring curvature. So this is just the definition. And now I can write the action as 1 over 8 pi g, the sum over faces of the trace of E of the face, U of the face. Where I'll say in a moment what is this trace. E of the face, E just lead on the face. U on the face, remember, is a product of different U's. So what I mean by this trace, this is an element of SU2. This is in the SU2 algebra, so R3, if you want. Well, simplest thing is just to write this as elements of this SU2 algebra. So if you write, for instance, many ways of doing this, you can write EF as a vector. You can write EF as EFI sigma I. And then this also, you know, any element of F, SU2 can be written as the exponential of something in the algebra, and there's a well-known formula that this is a cosine of alpha, I get it right, the identity, plus I sine of alpha sigma I. So when you trace, you get just this this part here. You get E alpha I. Okay? So with E defined in this manner as an element of the SU2 algebra, from that, this is what I get. And obviously, if you vary E, let's see if this is a good action. If you vary E, what you get? You get just these components here equals 0, which imply that all the alpha I equals 0, which imply that U is identity. So if you vary E, the equation of motion is that UF is the identity. So the curvature is 0, which doesn't mean that the connection has to be 0. Engage, transform the connection as you want. Questions? Now we have the discretization. We have the variables, we have the action, we have everything you want. Now let's go to the quantum theory, and let's look at the Hilbert space of this theory and the operators. And let's see if we can learn something about that. So this is space-time, n. It's three-dimensional. And there will be some boundary surface, some initial surface, if you want, two-dimensional sigma. So imagine you have space-time and you're sort of evolving from an initial surface to a final surface. So the Hilbert space, of course, it's at the initial and final surface, the boundary. You transition amplitude, you go from state in Hilbert space to another state of Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space lives here. It will be Hilbert space associated to the boundary. Now on the boundary, we'll have some boundary variables. So let's look at what are these boundary variables. Well, we have to, everything is triangulated here, so there's a triangulation here. So there will be a triangulation on the boundary. I'm triangles here. The boundary is two-dimensional, so the triangulation is going to be two-dimensional. Okay. And we're looking at the dual of the triangulation, so of these two complexes here. So these two complexes also will end up on the boundary, so there will be points here which are which are what? Which are in the center of this, which are cut through these faces. So the point, a point here on the boundary will be like that. And then there will be, the faces will be cut by this. So I'll have on the boundary the dual of the boundary triangulation. Okay? And this set of points and links here forms a graph. So on the boundary, there will be a graph, which I call gamma, which is formed by the nodes and the links. The nodes being dual to the triangles of the boundary, and the links being dual to the bones in the boundary. Okay? So this is the boundary graph, nodes and links. Okay? Absorb this terminology, otherwise we're going to lose forever. The triangular triangles, bones, vertices, edges, and faces are in the book. On the boundary, there are the nodes, which are the boundary of edges, and the links, which are the boundary of faces. Where are the boundary variables? Well, of course, there are group elements associated to edges, to edges. So there will be a group element associated to edges here. So the group elements sit on the on a group element goes from one iterator to another, so from one of these to another. So the group element associated to these links here. So on the boundary variables are element of SU2 associated to links. Okay? And what about the boundary variable of E? Well, E sits on bones, or if you want, faces, which is the same thing. So this is a bone. So there will be E associated to this bone here, which from the point of view of the graph is still a link. So on the boundary, for each link, there is a group element and a triad, a discretized triad. Which sort of makes sense, because if you have two dimensions, the graph is this one. So you have the group elements going from this triangle to this triangle, the spin connection that makes you change frame from here to here, and you have the length of this thing here. You have the thing giving the vector here. So it's exactly what you would do if you would discretize geometry in two dimensions. Not only that, but you also see that these are conjugate to one another, in the sense that, I'm not going through the details, but just you see it immediately. If you do the Hamiltonian theory, U sits here and E sits in front of it. Okay, so what you expect is these are going to be, in some sense, conjugate to one another, or properly conjugate to one another. So one is the position, one is the coordinate. One is the canonical coordinate, one is the canonic momentum. Okay? That's what we expect. We have the first order formalism. So omega and E are like Q and P in the quantum theory. That's a, each one is the first derivative, the other one in time, not the second derivative. So this gives us an indication of what we expect from the Hilbert space of the theory. We expect the Hilbert space of the theory. So we expect the quantum states. Let me put a gamma, because it's determined by the boundary graph, the Hilbert space. So for every boundary graph, I have a different Hilbert space here, depending on the triangulation. So what do we expect here? Let me choose one of the two variables to diagonalize, and I can diagonalize the group elements and write Hilbert states as functions of the group elements. That's what is usable to expect. So the Hilbert space is going to be a space of functions over a certain number of SU2 elements. Well, this is very nice, because functions on SU2 are things that mathematicians treat in all sorts of ways. We know how to do a lot of calculation. And especially, there's a nice measure on SU2, which is SU2 is a group, so it's the hard measure of the group. There's the invariant measure of the group. You want SU2 is a three sphere. So here is a three sphere. Right? You have a you have three directions and the length of this thing here, which go up to 2 pi. And there is an invariant measure on the three sphere, the one you take it by embedding four dimensions, taking the measure of the sphere, the symmetric measure of the sphere. So what I'm saying is that since there is a measure on SU2, I can take the space of the square integral functions, L2, of SU2, and I have one copy of SU2 for each link. So let me call L, big L, the number of links in the boundary graph, which is the same thing as the number of segments in the boundary graph. So this is going to be my Hilbert space associated to the graph gamma. OK? That's how I'm going to construct the theory on this Hilbert space. And I want these E variables to be sort of the conjugate operator here. So for each one of these UL, there is an EL. In fact, there are three of them, because this is a vector. This is an R3, which is the corresponding algebra. So I want an operator that act on these functions here, which transform in the as an element of the algebra, and which is differentiable first-order operator on the group, OK? Which is, you know, like saying, I want somebody who happens to be president of the United States, who happens to be have first name starting with O and last name start and the first name ending with A, and being black. I mean, how many there are? There's just one. Okay, there are many of these people there. So who is this thing? Who is this object here? It's going to be the left invariant vector field acting on L. So in other words, on the group there is a differential operator. Actually, a three differential operator, x, y, and z, which is defined how? Defined as follow, three components, I is 1, 2, 3, defined derivative, acting on a state psi of u, is defined as the derivative with respect to t of psi u, E I T, and here the generator of Pauli matrix. In fact, the generators of SU2 are the Pauli matrix divided by 2. So this is a definition of a derivative operator in the group in the direction given by the algebra element, and these things here transform like algebra element or operator transform like algebra element. Data relation of the algebra of SU2, and so on and so forth. So the obvious thing to do is to take for each link of the boundary an operator acting on the corresponding group. Okay. I've left some space here, because of course I can multiply here by a number. Which number? Well, let's just use canonical quantization to figure out the number. What is the conjugate momentum to U? The conjugate momentum to you is what sits in front of you, so it's not E, in fact. It's E divided by 8 pi g. Okay? So what we expect is that E divided by 8 pi g and U as a Poisson bracket, which up to indices and stuff like that, is going to be 1. So in other words, we expect the Poisson bracket between E and U discretized to be proportional to 8 pi g. Now we use canonical quantization, because at some point we have to invoke Heisenberg to tell us how to do quantum theory, and what Heisenberg tell us is to, or Dirac better, is that the corresponding quantum operators are going to be I h bar, the Poisson bracket. So these operators are going to be Poisson bracket of that, namely I h bar 8 pi h bar g. Now, this operator here, of course, what is a U operator? The U operator is just diagonal. This operator here, the commutation relation with U, obviously has a 1. So I want to multiply, I've written h bar twice, I want to multiply this by 8 pi h bar g to have the right object. The I is depending how you define this thing here. So if I define this thing here, I want a Hermitian one. Physicists use the Hermitian generator for generators of algebra. Mathematicians use the non-Hermitian one, I the Hermitian one. Yes?
Sorry, perhaps a stupid question to the definition of the operator Li. Do I multiply only the U corresponding to the face with the exponential, or do I multiply all the U's?
No, just one. Just its own.
Ah, okay.
Just its own. It's like d over dx I of x vector is the derivative in which you just take one component and you act on this one. It's a partial derivative. So here I wrote the general definition of L without any I indices, without any link indices. And but here I want the one that acts on. Okay?
So I have a question. How are these Poisson brackets defined? So E is function of x, U is function of. Or what is the canonical momentum? How is the Poisson bracket defined?
The Poisson bracket itself?
Well, what does it mean, what you are writing there?
Oh, you mean what is this one here?
Or what is the Poisson bracket, how it is defined?
I just was going super fast. What I really want is that there's an index. There are two things. First, there's a dependence on the point here, so I want a delta depending on the point. Of course, this is because this is in the action. First, there's a delta. No. This is an f prime. So of course here I'm going to have a delta f prime. Each one is just sort of it's fine. More importantly, this is the group, this is the algebra. So in fact, if you do it properly, what you get here is tau u. I didn't want to go through the full calculation of this. I'm going to compute the commutators of the group elements.
So E's are discretized. So they are not vectors, really. They are really, I assign to each phase, I assign one E to another phase.
In fact, you can do both things. You can start from the computational relation, the connection, and the continuum, and then from that compute the, start from the Poisson bracket of the connection and the E I A omega. Let me do E A I omega J B this is just delta x, y, delta a, b, delta j. Okay? But then if you compute, if you define u as the path ordered integral of that, you get e u, and here you get tau u, because do you really want me to go to the full thing? I just wanted to fix the. There's a long way of doing that. This is all in the old papers. Yes?
Could you remind me what tau is?
Oh, sorry. The generator of SEG.
So is it tau? Is tau here the.
If I, if this is in a point, and this is along a line L, let me start first but in the case in which this is L. So if x is not on L, I get 0, obviously. If x is in the initial point of E, here I have E of x, and the path ordered of exponential of omega tau, okay? So this only sees the first, the beginning of this integral here. So I get a tau that comes down, and then a delta, and then all these things, I get a u. If x is in the middle, then what I get is u1, u2, tau split with a tau in the middle. You can do these things in great details, and then you discover that you recover the same commutation relation with the operators. But I just didn't want to go into that, because it's a long, lot of calculation, a lot of algebra is useless. So I just used the fact that whatever you do in front here, there's always h pi g. So in the quantum theory, there will be always to be h pi h bar g. So what you want here is to have a pi h bar g. Okay. So let me put all these parentheses. If you want, I can spend 1 hour and do this and everything properly with all the. Yes.
Just again on the proper definition of the object as a symplectic manifold. We have the frame bundle cross the connection.
Bundle. In the continuum. In the continuum, you say.
Yeah. I mean, the frame bundle is.
Yeah.
Is, continuous.
We have we have a three-dimensional manifold. It has a tangent bundle. And then there is a principle SU2 bundle. Okay? This to start with the separator, because the connection by itself is a connection in an SU2 principle bundle, which a priori doesn't need to know anything about the tangent space. Okay? Then we have an object, a field, which is E, which it's a map in each point between the tangent space and a three-dimensional Minkowski space, which carries the vector representation of
that is the frame bundle.
Yeah. And that's given frame.
And
that's
right. The omega is our connection, is a SU2 algebra valued one form defined
that's right.
On the manifold?
That's right.
Okay.
That's
and
right.
And then we define our symplectic manifold as a cross product of those two.
Symplectic manifold, no, careful. The symplectic manifold, it's an infinite dimensional thing. You want the space of the fields omega and the space of the field E. The symplectic form leaves, that doesn't leave a...
The symplectic manifold is then the cross product of all sections
of
the first one cross...
That's right.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Okay. So at the end of the day, you can do things fancy and properly and whatever in various ways, but at the end of the day, what you get is just that. Or actually that. So this Hilbert space where your discrete variables, these two variables there, are represented as operators. U is just a multiplicative operator, just multiply that by U. And the triad is just this operator. And that's the Hilbert space of the quantum theory at this level of discretization. Okay? For each discretization, you have one. Now, immediately, you can do something. And you know what to do. You know immediately what. What can I can do physics from that. What can I do? What's the physics I can do here? How long is this? What's the length of this thing here? I want an answer. There's an equation giving the length written somewhere up there. Okay? The length square is the norm of the corresponding E thing. So the length is going to be the length of the L link, or more precisely, is not the L of the link. The length of the bone normal to cut by the link, okay? It's going to be just the norm of this thing here, right? So it's going to be by an operator in this Hilbert space, right? In fact, self-adjoint operator in this Hilbert space, which is what? Which is just you see? Can somebody give me the answer?
Find the spectrum of the length.
Sorry?
You can find the spectrum of the length operator.
And it's going to be how?
J plus one.
That's right. It's going to be discrete. So I want the length of one of these boundary bones, which I can write LL, because it's, each bone corresponds to a link. And L square is going to be 8 pi g h bar square times L b L v. I'll just use the definition of the length as a function of these things here, and these are the operators. But these are the generator of SU2. So that thing here is nothing else than the Casimir. So this is just 8 pi g h bar square, the Casimir of SU2. Okay? And I just open a book of mathematics and tells me that this operator here is a well-defined operator of this Hilbert space. Okay? So it's a Laplacian on this Hilbert space, this curved space. And its spectrum is discrete, which is pretty obvious because this is a compact space. Just a bunch of squared derivatives on a compact space, so its spectrum has to be discrete. Okay, and the eigenvalues are jj plus 1. So the eigenvalues of each one, for each one of the of these boundary bones, the spectrum is going to be h pi g h bar square root of j plus 1, which immediately tells me that in this theory, I have a prediction now. Any length is going to be one of these numbers. You say, wait a moment, you have done this on a given triangulation. Let's do in a different triangulation. Well, I do in a different triangulation, any length is going to be that same spectrum. On a finite triangulation, well, any length is going to be that same spectrum. So this doesn't depend on the triangulation I've chosen. The spectrum of the length in this theory is given by these numbers here. Okay? And you recognize that this is very much the same calculation that we did with the area with the literal room in the first class, except that now the 8 pi g, you see where it comes from. It comes from the 8 pi g, which is in front of the action of general relativity up there, plus the h bar. Okay? In two dimensions, g has dimensions appropriate that this, in fact, is a length. H bar g is a length, not a length square dimension. Okay? But now we can do much more, in fact. We can take these operators here. You see, you have one of these for each, you have many of those, right? You have one of these for each link. And they all commute, obviously, because each one acts on a different UL. So I can write a basis in this Hilbert space here, which diagonalizes all of them. Okay? And you will see that this is almost get at the point where I can write a complete basis here. Why? Because how much time I have? A few minutes. So last crucial piece. Gauge invariance, local gauge invariance. There is an SO3 local gauge invariance here. So I better to keep track of it and see what it happens. In other words, this Hilbert space here is a space where I've not told my states to be SO3 local gauge invariant. Okay? So I better remember to impose it. I have to impose the Gauss law, right? Divided by the local gauge invariant. How does the local gauge invariant happen here? Well, there are all sorts of ways in which you can find it. One is to actually write down the constraint and see what it is. One is to just think geometrically. What is the gauge invariance? Well, the gauge invariance is just rotating the frames where? Not at each link, of course, because once gauge invariance here, you can imagine you have a frame here, a frame here, a frame here, and the connection is moving from one to the other. So you can change your frame inside each triangle. So you have one gauge transformation for each node. Okay. What is a generator of a gauge transformation on one node? Well, you have to gauge transform this link, this link, and this link. So for every node, N, so you have a node of this graph with three links around. For every node N, you have a generator of the transformation, which is going to be by, if this is L1, this is L2, this is L3, is going to be L of L1 plus L of L2 plus L of L3, and they better be a constraint to generate local SO3 gauge invariance. Does this make sense? Look, well, this is we have seen what this object is. It is essentially the vector corresponding to the thing that cuts here. And this is one is the vector that corresponds to this one here, and this is one that corresponds to the vector here. Okay? So this plus this plus this must be zero. Of course it must be zero, right? If you have a triangle, you have the three vectors, they should sum up to zero. Right? That's the definition of a triangle. Three vectors, they sum up to zero. So this equation here, you can read it either as simply the requirement that this plus this plus this is zero, or the statement that the generator of your gauge invariance is the generator of the gauge invariance, so it's zero on the physical state, because when you do an SO3 and SO2 rotation here, you have to transform this and this at the same time, and this must be. So the physical space, by physical I mean invariant under SU2, is going to be L2 of SU2 divided by SU2 to the n, where n is the number of nodes. And the gauge transformations are psi of UL must be equal to psi, where you now you transform a link has two nodes, one and another one. So let me call this source, and this is target. So I have a lambda for the source of L, a lambda for the target of L. Well, lambda, so there's one for each node. One group element for each node is an element of SU2. So this is a space of states which are invariant on the set. Okay? And the local SO3 transformation. And now it turns out, and I probably don't have time to prove it now, prove it next time, that on this Hilbert space, these operators here are gauge invariant. Well, they always are, they're Casimir, so they're not going to transform like that. Okay? And they form a complete commuting set. I'll show it next time. So if you diagonalize this, you get a basis on that Hilbert space there. It means that a basis is given by just assigning a spin to each link. So there is a basis UJL of UL, which I can write ULJL. I write it explicitly, these things here. Which is a basis in the Hilbert space, and that's called the spin network basis. Now, if you feel very energetic, which you don't look like, this afternoon you can work out by yourself this basis entirely. So write explicitly, for every assignment of JL, write explicitly this function of the UL. It's not very difficult. You just think a little bit about SU2 representation theory and you can do. But I'll do it tomorrow in detail, so you see explicit as it works. So I have a Hilbert space, I have a complete set of commuting observable, I diagonalize them, and I can write the basis explicitly. Okay. So this is a spin network basis. These are the length operator. And the corresponding quantum state, I can imagine the quantum state as follows. So I have my graph. So this is a boundary graph, just this, the red thing. The three or four, sorry, in two dimensions. Etc. I have a graph gamma. I have a spin J to each one of these, J1, J2, JL, J. And this is a quantum state of the theory. What it does represent? It represents some bunches of space here. Okay. So it's they are like triangles. This is a triangle. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. So this is a triangle. and here there's another triangle. And the length of this line cut by this is given by this spin here. So I have this bunch of quanta of space, which are triangles, such that the length of each one is given by this. Okay? Spin are discrete, are not continuous. And this is the Hilbert space and the geometry of this three-dimensional quantum gravity. What I still have to do is to write the transition amplitudes from some boundary state to some boundary state. And this will be easily written once I have this, this machinery here. Questions? OK, so we're already deep into the form here, in the structure. There's network state, the geometrical operator, the quantization. What is missing is the transition amplitudes. So what I'll do tomorrow is first write explicitly this change of basis from the group elements as a basis to the spin as a basis. It's just a Fourier transform in SU2, essentially. Right? And then write the transition amplitudes. And then three-dimensional quantum gravity is completed. And then task will be the same, to redo the same in four dimensions. No questions? Because you have a question.
So when you went to the physical Hilbert space, the result was just a quotient by n copies of SU2.
That's right.
Why exactly do we quotient? I understand we have kind of n different SU2 invariances, but I'm not sure why we would quotient to explain that mathematically.
It's exactly the same that happens in Maxwell theory, if you want. If you quantize the theory for getting the gauge invariance and forgetting the Gauss law, starting from the canonical theory, you get three photons instead of two. And then you have to sort of impose the Gauss law. So you can view there are all sorts of different ways in which you can view this. For instance, in the canonical theory, there is a constraint. Obviously, if you take the continuous theory, you work out the Hamiltonian, which is zero, there's a constraint, is the dynamics, but then there's this local gauge invariance, so-called SO3 gauge invariance, which give a constraint, and the constraint is, in fact, Gauss law. When you do it, go to the discrete, the quantization of the constraint is this one, and you have to impose this strongly on the states to get the physical state. That's Dirac way of treating the constraint, where this is one for each n. Okay. So the space of states here that satisfies that is the subspace of the Hilbert space here. In fact, it's the proper subspace of this physical, which is that.
Is diffeomorphism invariance already taken into account?
Yes, because it's a good question. Yes, because you see, there are two ways of playing this game. One is to say, let me have a manifold. Let me embed this triangulation in the manifold, okay? And then I have to remember that diffeomorphism moves the triangulation around in the manifold. So if you do it this way, you have to explicitly have the position of the triangulation all over. So everything is labeled by the position of the triangulation in the manifold. Then what does it mean to divide by the diffeomorphism constraint? It means to factor out the position of the triangulation on the manifold, right? So divide by the position of the manifold. So to erase all this dependence here. Okay. Now you can think differently. Forget about the position of the manifold, and these states here are just not sitting on a manifold somewhere, just where the quantum space are by themselves. In other words, a discretized, don't think about the equation of motion because it's going to be confusing that this is flat. So four dimensions would be exactly the same. A discretized geometry here, you can think of the geometry which is flat inside of each one of these tetrahedra and curved on this, on the bones. Okay? Now, this is not a metric. This is a, if the way I've described it is a geometry. So it's an equivalence class of metrics and a coordinate transformation. There's an actual curvature on each one of the bones. So if you make a diffeomorphism, what you change is the metric description of that, but the geometry is uniquely determined by this curvature on each one of the bones. So in other words, you end up with a picture which is automatically diffeomorphic environment.
But if we consider the canonical approach to quantum gravity, imposing the diffeomorphism constraint gives you that the basis is not its spin networks, right? How do you see that here? Are these somehow related to equivalence plus or not? Or?
The spin networks are a space of diffeomorphic invariant state, three-dimensional diffeomorphic invariant state. Let me split the space-time diffeomorphism from the space diffeomorphism. Okay, the space-time diffeomorphism, let me put them aside. Let me talk about the space diffeomorphism here. The the space diffeomorphism, what they do is they just take a spin network and move it on the manifold. So if I define the spin networks abstractly, they are already the space of space diffeomorphism. The space-time diffeomorphism is much more complicated because the quantum generator of space-time diffeomorphism is the Hamiltonian constraint. So to solve the Hamiltonian constraint, I have to go down to the physical space. And remember the discussion about quantum system without time. This is equivalent of projecting the operator that projects it is the transition amplitudes. So in fact, the full four-dimensional space-time diffeomorphism are taking it into account only when you consider transition amplitudes. In the sense you forget about it, and you just consider transition amplitude between partial observables, which are not four-dimensional diffeomorphic invariant, only three-dimensional diffeomorphic invariant, but the transition amplitude themselves are. I don't know if this answers your question. Okay. Other questions? So if any of you can work out explicitly the form of this psi JL of UL for tomorrow, he gets a piece of chocolate. See you tomorrow.